Hey Junkions, this episode is brought to you by Fun Size Horror, a free online platform for original and user-submitted horror shorts. Because if there's one thing horror fans know, it's that if we can't find good stuff in the theaters, we're gonna take it in the shorts. If you're a filmmaker looking for a place to share your film and grow your audience, go to funsizehorror.com. Submitted films can be eligible for promotions, contests, and distribution. Follow Fun Size Horror on Twitter, at Fun Size Horror, and like them on Facebook, also at Fun Size Horror, conveniently enough. And stay up to date on the latest releases, contests, and promotions.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
How can you not? How can you not get behind a movie that has a theme song like that?
By Dokken, of all things.
It was, you know what? That could have just as easily been the theme song for this show. We could have opened every episode with Dokken's Dream Warriors.
I'm actually surprised. Like, that theme was so good. And it being the 80s, I'm surprised they didn't use it seven times like they did in last week's movie.
This is true.
Where in Over the Top, you hear the same Log Dog song.
You don't like the Log Dog? Log Dog?
That's what we're going to call it from now on. Greg has coined
it. Thank you, Greg.
The Log Dog song. And you play that seven times. We don't get Dream Warriors, but at the end of the credits,
yeah,
like you don't open with it.
And there's
you don't have it playing on the radio when she's cranking the radio.
And insult, hey, meet injury. There's another Dokken song in the movie that's not Dream Warriors.
Yeah,
it makes no sense. But welcome to the Snake Pit, Junkions. It's time for another dreamy episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on FilmSchoolRejects.com. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so good it just has to be fattening. I'm your host Brian Salisbury, joined as per usual by my friend and co-host, screenwriter, novelist, Lieutenant Megaforce, Dream Warrior himself, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
Hello. And just so you know, if you want to hear more of our musings about Dokken and its application within films, you can find our back catalog on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. If you go to iTunes, please leave us a review, a 5-star rating. We really appreciate those. Those really help us move up that list and get more listeners. That's what we're aiming for. That's what we're trying to invade your dreams and make sure that even in your nightmares while you're sleeping, you will still hear our dulcet tones. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. We also have Amazon links now. We are a Amazon affiliate. So anytime you want to buy or rent the movies that we talk about, or if you want to buy anything from Amazon, if you use our links to get there, that actually supports the show, and we very much appreciate it. And we really appreciate those of you who have decided to become patrons. We have had
thank you guys.
I am so humbled, guys. We've had an influx of new patronage over the last month. I am completely blown away by your generosity. Thank you so much for becoming patrons. And as a reward, we will be doing a whole series of bonus content just for you. Mailbags, Summer of 77, of course. Top
five. Which
starts
this week.
Oh, this week is our first Summer of 77 title.
And it's one of your favorite. It's a title that if I were to ask you, you get a choice of 77 movies. You can keep Star Wars or you can keep The Car.
Ooh, that's a real...
That's a Sophie's choice for you.
Ooh, man, yeah.
Like, that's how much you love this movie. Now, I know there's people out there going, what? But
for you
love this movie so much. Like, of course we're kicking off Summer of 77 with The Car.
Of course we are. But we, right now, are slashing our way through Summer of 87, and we have arrived at, I think, one of the single greatest horror sequels of all time. And I am, of course, talking about 1987's A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors.
It's 1987. Do you know where Freddy is? No waking up from this nightmare. No! A Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 3, Dream Warriors, rated R.
Now showing at a theater near you.
Or more appropriately, the Dream Warriors, never gonna get old.
You know what? See, that's the thing is they called for the Dream Child.
Yeah.
And
No, they called Five the Dream Child. Four is the Dream Master.
Dream Master, yes.
Directed by Renny Harlin.
Yeah. Should have been called Don't Want to Dream No More. Nightmare on Elm Street 4, Don't Want to Dream No More. Like, just hold on to that.
Every sequel after part three should have just been, after the colon, secondarily titled a lyric from the Dawkins song Dream Warriors.
So what we've got here is we have this wonderful moment in the 80s where the structure of horror sequels changed for a brief moment, where what happened was in 86, a guy named Cameron came around and said, how do you make a sequel to one of the greatest sci-fi horror films of all time? Well, you take it from a horror movie structurally and you turn it into an action movie. You take it, turn it into a mission movie. And that would be copied a couple other times in other franchises mm-hmm. and work out. Mm-hmm. And here you have what some people think is arguably the best Nightmare on Elm Street movie. Mm-hmm. You know, the big debate is between one and three. You never hear people go, no, you know, I think you're wrong. I think four or two is actually...
It's Freddy's Dead, said no one.
Yeah, Jason Murphy.
Fuck, Jason Murphy, you are officially barred from ever being on this show again.
He's actually turned me on to revisit.
Oh, don't. No, because then he's going to have you watching the prequels next. Don't listen to him. He's a heretic.
Okay, that is also true.
He's a fucking heretic.
Yes. So anyhow.
Who I love very much.
We love you, Jason. So you've got a couple times where it really, really, really works. Mm-hmm. Aliens is a perfect example. Nightmare on Elm Street 3 is a perfect example. Hellbound Hellraiser 2 is a perfect example. Where what you do is you give the characters some real agency in the world they're existing in.
Exactly.
You know, in Alien, they didn't have weapons to fight against them, but in Aliens, they do. They have agency, right. And that makes the threat even scarier. In, you know, here in Dream Warriors, we actually have these kids utilize the fact that they're in a dream to defend themselves.
Yeah.
And this is the first time this has really entered into this series. The idea of lucid dreaming, since what Freddy's doing is pulling you into a lucid dream, you can actually fight back.
Yeah.
And that is executed so well here, and done really interestingly, in a way that creates a really iconic nightmare film with some of the best death scenes in the entirety of the series.
For sure. And movies like this are always interesting to me because, and especially in horror, characters who we've previously known as victims are taking up arms, as the Bard would say if he were a fan of Dream Warriors, against those supernatural forces that had been victimizing them. And I think, it's really interesting to see this happening in this era of films, because the other, like, there are instances such as Aliens, as you mentioned. Also, if you look at what happens with Ash in the Evil Dead series around this time,
yeah.
And if you look at, there were at least two different characters in two different Friday the 13th sequels who were one-off dead meats, but their characters would show up at the camp trying to find and kill Jason to avenge what they thought was the death of a loved one at his hands.
Well, and as we talked about a few weeks ago, Friday the 13th, part 7.
Yeah.
Which also gives the character agency, the ability to fight back. She has supernatural powers of her own.
Yes, exactly.
The only reason I didn't mention that in the list is I mentioned the really good ones, the ones that people perpetually think are the best, whereas, you know, a lot of people disagree with, you know, our take on 7.
But, you know, it's funny, such is my lack of knowledge with the Hellraiser franchise that when you said Hellbound, I was like, Chuck Norris was in a Hellraiser movie?
No, Hellbound, Hellraiser 2.
Got it.
Which I think, and most of the people I've ever talked to think is the superior film in the Hellraiser series. But a couple people are like, no, it's Hellraiser. And it's like, no, go back and watch Hellraiser and then Hellraiser 2. Hellraiser 2 is much tighter, much more fun, much more enjoyable. And really, like, one is more of a personal horror tale. And two is the one where it's very much like Friday the 13th part 2, where it really is like, oh wait, no, this is what this series is about.
Right.
Like, the Cenobites really have to be a part of it. It's not just a creepy tale of people pursuing the supernatural. It is deep into the supernatural, which is what they do here. Like, these kids from the this is one of the things I love about this movie. From the beginning, there's only two characters that doubt that Freddy is real. And they're not any of the major characters.
Yeah.
They're, you know, you have the doctor who is, you know, one of the side, you know, one of the important side characters. And then his boss. But ultimately, these kids know this guy is real and is coming for them. And then, you know, your favorite actress to ever walk the earth, Heather Langenkamp.
Watch your shoes there. You're stepping all over my lines here.
Yeah, look, here's the thing is that I was watching this with my wife again last night, and she hadn't seen it since she was a kid, you know, since, you know, she was a teenager. And so she didn't remember it. And I was like, Heather Langenkamp shows up. I just look at her. I'm like, you know, I love Heather Langenkamp. You know, Brian fucking hates her, but I don't get it. And then a couple lines come out of her mouth and just is like, she's not very good. And I'm like, shut up, shut up. You're not wrong, but shut up. Like, it was literally like the stiffest dialogue in the film. And I was just like, oh, God damn it. Don't let Brian be right. Don't let Brian be right.
Yeah, I know that's your worst nightmare.
God, Brian.
You know, my problem with Heather Langenkamp.
Why do you torment me so?
Because that's what I do. My problem with Heather Langenkamp is that she doesn't so much act as she does just barrel dead-faced right through her lines, like right through the scenes. Just like there is no emotion. Like you watch her in quote, I'm using quotation fingers, you can't see because it's a podcast, but engaging with the other actors in a scene. And it's like, what do the words mean again? Oh yeah, I'll get it eventually. Like, and I get why she's brought back. I really do. And before we go any further into that, and before this just becomes the Friars Club roast of Heather Langenkamp, we should describe the plot
here. Just the 10 of us.
Yeah. We should describe the plot of A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, which is that we are introduced to a character named Kristen at the beginning of this movie who is having a real tough time. You can obviously see she's being tormented by Freddy Krueger. And
who is she?
Patricia Arquette.
Patricia Arquette in
her first movie.
And her first time working with Angelo Badalamenti.
What? You're going to have to fill me in. What
the,
now?
The person who did the score for this movie would later go on to score Lost Highway.
Oh, okay.
You know, David Lynch's movie that she's in. And I had never like put it together that these movies are two Patricia Arquette movies with Badalamenti scores. And oddly enough, I bring that up because this is the Angelo Badalamenti score that I assume that you hate because it has the thing that you loathe the most.
Score in a box?
Score in a box.
Yeah.
And it's Angelo Badalamenti doing Score in a Box, which normally he's genius. Like, he's a genius composer, and this is not his finest hour, but it's him working with Patricia Arquette.
What's funny is so forgettable to me is the score of this movie that when you said, when you mentioned the score, I immediately thought you were talking about Dokken. I know that's wrong in my head,
but that was
the association I made immediately when you said the music.
This movie feels like it should have been scored like with Dokken, like allowing, you know, Dokken to do what Goblin did on.
Yeah, there we go. Dokken A right, man. Dokken A right.
Dude, that would have been, like, this movie feels like, I mean, there's so much heavy metal 80s-ness in this movie that we're going to get into. But this movie's got fucking wizards. It's got a punk rock chick with switchblades. It's got like this big strong-ass dude just like busting through walls. It's got, you know, talking about hallowed ground. Like, it is, it, this movie is heavy metal as fuck. I mean, it is as 87 as it fucking gets without
no wimps.
What?
No wimps?
No wimps. No false metal.
There it is.
Yeah, sorry, that was a callback to Summer of 86.
Hey, bringing it all the way back around. No, you're absolutely right. So Kristen is being tormented by Freddy Krueger. It leads her to the point where she tries to take her own life with a razor blade. She is committed to a hospital called Weston, I believe is the name of the hospital. And she meets a group of other patients who are all having similar dream issues. They're suicidal. They have group therapy together. And wouldn't you know it, the new employee on the ward is this graduate student hotshot, Nancy Thompson, who early on in this process starts to realize the one thing that's bonding these kids is the person tormenting them in their dreams. And that is where we kind of run with things until the big reveal, spoiler alert, these are the last of the children of Elm Street, and that is why they are being tormented. Dig it. I love it. I love the concept. I love the setup. I love the idea that not only are we going the aliens route of the hunters becoming, or the hunted becoming the hunters, but also you have a bunch of very heavily damaged characters who are incredibly empathetic in a slasher sequel.
yeah, they really break all the horror movie tropes here. That's one of the great things about this movie. It's why this movie is so beloved amongst the critic set. You get all the same tropes that you get in a general horror movie cast, but they aren't put together in the same way. These aren't a group of friends going off together. These aren't, you know, people who hang out together. There's no romances going on. You know, it's not, you don't have a bunch of reasons for these characters to hook up and then have gratuitous sex scenes. Instead, it's a bunch of kids that would ordinarily, from all walks of life, that would ordinarily not be hanging out with each other, but have all kind of bonded over this, having this same madman torment them in their dreams and not understanding where this is coming from, and bonding because no one else will listen to them and they're the only ones who understand each other.
It's rare, because the other thing that breaks tropes is that you don't have characters that just show up to be killed.
Yeah.
This movie is really taking the time to flesh these characters out. And a big part of that is because this is, if I'm not mistaken, the debut of a certain screenwriter, little Frankie Darabont.
Yeah. He's one of four screenwriters credited on this.
The one of the other ones, of course, is also director Chuck Russell.
This is our second time talking about Chuck Russell this
year. Chuck Russell is a blue-collar JFC champion. I mean, he wrote Dreamscape, which we talked about a few weeks ago.
And directed Dreamscape.
Did he direct?
Oh, wait, no.
No. He wrote Dreamscape.
That's right.
He wrote Dreamscape. He wrote and directed this. He wrote and directed The Blob remake.
Yes.
Which is fucking incredible.
Which is one of those movies I can't believe we haven't covered yet.
Well, stay tuned if we do a Summer of 88. I can tell you that. That'll
probably
right
happen.
Away. He also got, this is, and I found this out, big plug to The Movie Crypt, because I found this out listening to their interview with him, which is a phenomenal fucking interview. You should all be listening to The Movie Crypt. He got his start directing Second Unit on Death Race 2000.
Oh, that's fucking awesome.
He was one of those guys that was just an eager beaver. Whatever job he could get on any movie, he would do it to the best of his ability. And he was helping Paul Bartel, who directed Death Race 2000 for Roger Corman. And he was just kind of working as an AD. And he said to Paul Bartel, he's like, do you need some pickup shots of these characters in their cars? Because I'll do that. And Bartel let him do it. So a lot of the times when you see a character driving in a car in Death Race 2000 and having dialogue, Chuck Russell directed that.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's pretty fucking cool. So, yeah, he's one of those guys that, like, we have not, up until this year, we really haven't talked a lot about, but he is a dyed-in-the-wool JFC champion who we will be talking about again. But he's a guy who really believes in the idea that no matter what movie you're making, you add heart to it. And when you look at movies that he's been a part of, like Dreamscape, for example,
yeah,
there's a lot of heart in Dreamscape. In fact, the little kid in the wheelchair who's being tormented in his dreams, that moment always gets me. It's a real, you know, tearjerker. And there's a character in this movie who's in a wheelchair being tormented in his dreams, which I can't help but feel is kind of a callback to that. Yeah. Although, my God, when that kid goes into the dreams and becomes a quote-unquote wizard master, that outfit they give him looks like it's straight out of the vampire's tomb. I mean,
it's delightfully 80s cheesy in the best way.
Yeah, but it looks more, like the collar is so high, he looks like if Bela Lugosi was at the end of the movie Big and turning back into a little kid.
But dude, that's what was happening in fantasy in the 80s. Fantasy had gotten ridiculous by this point in the
80s. Oh, okay.
Where Dungeons & Dragons and fantasy had gone, it started getting, because it started mixing with the whole heavy metal culture, and you started getting nerds who were listening to heavy metal and playing Dungeons & Dragons, and watching these movies, and it all kind of blended together, and fantasy just got weird for a while. It's why fantasy fell out of favor for a while, was because it had gotten so weird and ridiculous that you couldn't take it seriously anymore. Like, it started off in some really badass places, and then in the 70s got dark and deep, and you get stuff like Elric of Menibinay coming out, you know.
Wow.
And, like, you start getting this real hard-edged fantasy, and then everyone's Dungeons & Dragons campaigns took over the writing of fantasy, and stuff just got weird. And so, like, that looked like what was happening in fantasy in that era. So when you look back and go, that looks goopy as fuck, it's like, yeah, but that's kind of what people thought was cool for a hot minute in the late 80s, which is decidedly uncool. There was a reason why, like, second edition AD&D really kind of fell out of favor. Like, that was the death of D&D, and everyone thought it was over until Wizards of the Coast bought it back at the end of the 90s and created third edition. And now it's like, it's the cool Hollywood chic thing to do now is you have people like, oh yeah, I play D&D on Friday nights. And it's so weird that that's a thing that became hip.
Yeah. Well, that's good to know. I mean, and what was it like playing D&D in the Dust Bowl, Cargill? Like, those are the things I really need to know.
Well, you know, you often had to sell one or two of your children for a good set of dice.
And was it hard to roll 20s on a skipping stone? Was that tough to do?
Well, it was hard to do without a house. I mean, you know, you're playing in a box, so you have your home also serves as your DM screen.
And you had to dump all the cobalts on the ground because the price was too, you had to drive up a shortage because there was a surplus.
That
right.
is exactly it.
Okay, that's good to know.
So yeah, but so yes, back.
Cargill's old. The bullet point, the TLDR of what we just did, the exchange we just had. TLDR, Cargill is old. Continue.
So Dream Warriors.
In addition to Heather Langenkamp, who we mentioned, in addition to Patricia Arquette, who we mentioned, this movie also features the appearance of one Larry Fishburne.
Yes.
Boop, 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 boop.
Which, you know, tying that back into what you were saying before we got into the whole Wizard Cloak thing, one of the other interesting things about this movie and its heart is everyone in this movie working in the hospital, except for one kind of sleazy douchebag, really genuinely cares about these kids.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Like, there's none of that Nurse Ratched shit in this movie. Like, this is, Nurse Ratched kind of became a trope for these kind of movies where, you know, you get these abusive people or people that are just doing their job and don't care and don't like it's kind of rough watching the sequence where Patricia Arquette is flipping the fuck out and doesn't want to be sedated, and everyone's trying to sedate her, and Larry Fishburne goes in and gets fucking sliced by a scalpel, and it's like, that dude is like legitimately trying to take care of this girl. Like, he thinks she's lost her shit because they just don't, he has no idea what the fuck's like. Larry Fishburne, oddly enough, is the anti-Morpheus in this movie. He's the only character in this movie who's never told what the fuck is going on. Like, he never hears about Freddy Krueger, doesn't understand why some girl mysteriously goes through a TV. He's just completely in the fucking dark.
Yeah.
And then kind of bends the rules a couple of times for better or for worse, which we'll actually get into that here in a little bit.
Yeah, but you're right. There's no Nurse Ratched. There's no male nurse licking face from Terminator 2. Like, these are all, like, 90% of the staff. Even the character who is kind of Nurse Ratched, who's the hospital administrator, thinks she's right. Like, she's not doing anything because she's selfish or because it's in the hospital's best interest. Literally, the only thing she really argues with is using an experimental drug on children.
Yeah, we're not going to use an experimental drug on these teenagers. Are you out of your mind?
You can't fault her for that. But I do like that this is the movie that introduces Hypnosil, which becomes a huge plot point in Freddy vs. Jason, which, take a drink, because, oh my God, will we be talking about that movie at some point. But, so Larry Fishburne, a.k.a. Lawrence Fishburne, a.k.a. Cowboy Curtis, a.k.a.
Is Morpheus.
A.k.a. Is it New Jack City yet?
A.k.a. We're going to Applebee's.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So he's in the movie, as is The Return. Now, when you talk about returns in this movie, you can talk about Heather Langenkamp all day long. But the one I'm interested in is that this film also features the return of the incredible, the macho is all hell, John motherfucking Saxon.
Yeah, Saxon comes back as a special appearance, despite the fact that he probably gets more dialogue than some of the kids.
Definitely more than the deaf kid, for sure. Or he's not deaf, he's mute. There's a deaf kid in a different sequel that they kill, and then even, you know, I think the Americans with Disabilities Act would have a real problem with Freddy Krueger, because he's killed a lot of kids with disabilities. In this movie alone, he kills two kids with two different disabilities. So, and then he kills a deaf kid in part 6. It's not a good look, Freddy. That's all. I know you're a heinous child murderer, but dude, there's a line. Come on. John Saxon, Lieutenant Donald Thompson, back to save the day. That guy.
Except not really.
Not really. But in my mind, to save the day. That guy is cooler than the other side of an Eskimo's pillow. I am so happy that he is back in this movie. For a long time, I actually had an action figure of him from Enter the Dragon, which I referred to as my John Saxon figure. And I hope to have in the future more John Saxon figures. So we need one of Lieutenant Donald Thompson. Have the one from Enter the Dragon. Definitely going to need one from the sheriff character in Black Christmas and the sheriff character in Blood Beach. Because that's what he did. He played sheriffs in horror movies.
I am so disappointed in you. You have no idea how disappointed in you.
Why?
I am. Where was your mention of a Sator action figure?
I'm sorry. It would just be a floating
Sator?
Head.
Sator?
It would be a floating head. You're right. It would be like basically a Zordon action figure. Just be a floated head with a David Bowie stripe.
No, it would be a Sator action figure where you could remove the arm and put on the Nestor arm.
Oh, that's true. That's very true.
It would be fucking awesome.
Yeah,
those of you out there that don't know what we're talking about, Battle Beyond the Stars.
Go back to our catalog. Go back to our archive. Sorry about that.
Yeah, or Battle Beyond the Stars, one of our very first episodes, one of my favorite movies of all time.
Or ask your grandparents if they're handy about Battle Beyond the Stars. So
what is up with making fun of old people, Dad?
You're so old. It's not my fault you're old. You can take it out of me if you want. But we mentioned that Chuck Russell wrote this, and then he also wrote Dreamscape, wrote this with Frank Darabont. The plots are very similar because they both revolve around someone who has discovered the psychic ability to physically pull people into someone else's dream. And that's exactly what's going on here with the Kristen character, that she's actually the conduit to be able to pull the other kids in this facility into these dreams. And that's when they decide to go after Freddy Krueger. We have one kid named Kincaid, who is just a foul-mouthed, bad attitude kid.
Run DMC loving
kid, who, by the way, apparently got this role because he didn't want to audition for it. His agent made him go to the audition. He had to take a bus there in the rain, was several hours late to, or like they kept him waiting for several hours. And when he got in there, Chuck Russell told him to just do whatever felt natural. So what he did was tell Chuck Russell to go fuck himself. And Chuck Russell's like, you're hired.
You're hired. And he's good.
He's so good. Everyone's good in this movie.
In fact, the thing that's so fucking frustrating about this movie is that they, in the fourth movie, they then go and pull a fucking Aliens 3 on us.
Yeah.
And fucking waste them right at the fucking beginning.
Yeah.
Like, it's really, like, it's like, what? Fuck you.
Fuck you, Rennie Harlan.
I love Kincaid.
How would we extrapolate from that Rennie Harlan loves to kill beloved black characters? We really should have seen Deep Blue Sea coming. That's all I'm saying. But yeah, so one of the things that is, I think, a little problematic is that in the first Nightmare on Elm Street, that movie owes a lot to Psycho, because they pull that gimmick where you think one character, one female character, is going to be the protagonist. We spend a little bit of time with her, and then she is shockingly killed off in the first act, which it accomplishes a couple of different things. It creates tension for the rest of the movie because the audience is shocked into thinking anybody can die. And it cleared the way for Nancy to become the clear protagonist from that point forward. Dream Warriors wants to recapture that effect, I feel. But they wait far too long to, spoiler alert, kill off Nancy. And I know what you're thinking is that, you know, if you wait that long to kill off a character, then it's not really the Psycho conceit. It's just a major character being killed off in the third act. And that's fine. But the movie is so much about Nancy that by the time she finally bites it, we feel like we barely know who Kristen is at all.
Yeah. Well, and the genius of the original Nightmare versus the remake is that it tricks you brilliantly. Wes Craven tricks you brilliantly because you think it's not, you think it's about, what's her name again? Kristen. It the blonde?
Yeah.
You think it's about her simply because the movie opens with her nightmare, and then she's in the next 10 minutes of the movie. But what you don't realize is that Nancy is also in
I'm sorry, you're talking about the first one.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't remember what the blonde girl's name is in the first one, but I will figure that out.
Yeah, I forget what her, because she's literally killed off, you know.
This is what I'm saying. Yeah.
But the brilliance of that and why that works is because Nancy is literally in
Tina.
Every...
Sorry, her name is Tina.
Nancy's literally in every scene after that. Like, so for the rest of the film, it's, you know, it's like when she dies, you're like, oh, I thought she was the main character, but you only think she's the main character because the movie opens with her. When you go back and rewatch the original Nightmare, Nancy's there almost the whole fucking movie. Like, she doesn't just show up out of the blue.
Yeah, no, and I get that, but they get rid of Tina in such an efficient way that we can then get to know Nancy, and Nancy becomes the clear protagonist, where in this one it's like, oh, that's right, Kristen, you're still here, so I guess it's basically a problem at the helm. There are too many captains, and I will admit part of this is probably just my dislike of Heather Langenkamp, but it's like, we really, like, when we see moments of her, like, going out on a date with the doctor and, like, all this other stuff, and it's like,
let's let's start with this for a moment. Are they dating or not?
I have no idea.
That's one of the weird things about this movie. Like, this movie's so fucking
lame. Do you know why I have no idea? Do you want to know why I have no idea? Because Heather Langenkamp has no fucking chemistry with this actor. And there's literally, during that dinner scene, she's trying to push him to use Hypnosil, and he puts his foot down and says no. And there's literally, the last shot before the cut is her pouting with her chopsticks. A grown woman pouting. And it's just like, I don't know. This, because of that, and because of their age difference, it felt creepy. Like, it didn't feel like a date. And maybe this is why we don't know if they were actually dating. It felt like something else. It felt like a more
You don't know if it's I'm getting to know you or there's a relationship. Like, this is one of the films
because they
feel is one of the film's only flaws.
Okay.
Like, one of the film's only major flaws is that there's a relationship in this movie that we have no idea and they give us no information about. Like at the, this movie ends and he's got her dream protector, but that's, is it, does he have it because he misses her and because he had a spark with her or does he have it to protect him from Freddy? Like, what the fuck is that there for?
I have a feeling the end of this movie was producer notes, because we do need to mention this is a Nightmare on Elm Street movie. So it's a New Line film. So Bob Shea's in control, and there's a lot that happens in the last 2 minutes of this movie that seems so slapdash that it feels like reshoots. It feels like somebody was like, we need a tie-up for this, and we need to figure this out. And because literally it's like Freddy's dead, there's a funeral, which, by the way, an odd thing about the Elm Street franchise that I just noticed while watching this, more than any other franchise in this decade, this series is all about funeral scenes.
Oh, God, yes. And hazy, smoky, like Vaseline on the lens funeral scenes.
It's like
that's that look, that Vaseline lens daytime scene look, I always think of as the Elm Street look, because all of those 3, 4, 5, and 6 all fucking have those.
Yeah. And I think I only discovered this recently after I unfortunately had to attend a funeral this week, but a chunk of the budget on every Elm Street sequel goes directly to empty caskets and extras delivering eulogies. It is, there are no funerals in Friday the 13th. There are no funerals in Halloween. I mean, it would suggest that this series is interested in establishing these characters, as human, as, you know, there's a finite amount of time they have on this planet, and make them a little bit more grounded. And the later sequels, I would contest that that's not true, but in Dream Warriors, the only thing that's more prevalent than headstones and pallbearers is character moments, so I get that. But yeah, you're right. It is like, we are gathered today to lay to rest this industrial-sized tub of Vaseline that we've put on the lens, all the faithful departed, blah, 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 blah. But yeah, that's something I noticed in this viewing. It's like, this franchise loves funeral scenes, and the remake has a couple of funeral scenes.
Yeah.
It is crazy. But the reason I say that is, after Freddy is dead, we have a funeral scene again that cuts immediately to the headstone, because this is the movie where we find out about Freddy Krueger's parentage.
Well, we're going to go into that. Like, this is actually the beginning, the very first movie that starts giving us the mythology of Freddy Krueger, which actually led me to a new fan theory. That I have a crazy fan theory.
Oh, buckle up, Junkions. It's time for a fan theory.
Yeah, no, but... No, I was going to get to it in a little bit, but we'll jump into it. This is where we start finding out about the real mythology, the supernatural mythology of Freddy Krueger. Because beforehand, he was just a child murderer. They wanted to make him a child molester. The studio said, no fucking way. And so they went with child murder. Now, we always knew he was a child molester. Like, that's just an assumed fact. Like, why would he just kidnap children and murder them? Like, there's got to be something more to it. But in this one, we find out two very, very important pieces of mythology. One, he is the bastard son of 100 maniacs.
Which, by the way, awesome. Just that sentence, that one sentence log line of a backstory, amazing.
You know, his mother was a nun who got captured and kept secret for days in the fucking insane asylum
and
was
snake pit.
Raped repeatedly, because having your villain be a child molester is unacceptable. Having your villain's mother have been raped repeatedly over the course of days, I guess that's okay.
I just imagine Frank Darabont and Chuck Russell like, sitting in the writer's room going, how in the fuck will we find an ounce of humanity in Freddy Krueger? Got it!
And then the second big mythology point is that the souls of the children that he murders make him stronger.
They sustain him.
They sustain him. And my fan theory, which is not supported, and probably anyone anyone attached to it goes, no, that wasn't what was really going
look,
on.
Look, we are not above saying unfounded things on this podcast. No, so you go right
but
ahead.
But no, look, imagine this series through this lens for a moment.
Is there Vaseline on that lens or no?
Lots of it.
Lots of it. Okay.
Since Freddy Krueger was not a child molester, he was a child murderer, why was he murdering children? What if Freddy Krueger was attempting to appease supernatural things and gain supernatural power, and becoming Freddy Krueger was exactly what he wanted to do? Like, what if Freddy Krueger isn't just a revenge-seeking, you know, former child molester murderer? What if he always wanted to be a powerful supernatural entity, so he was murdering children and sacrificing them, and then ultimately gained that power he was looking for, and then realized he could gain more and more power through terrorizing children and then taking their souls?
That would fix a problem I've had with this franchise for a long time.
Which is
the fact that it's a character getting revenge for being himself the target of revenge, which just seems redundant and kind of blurs the whole moral compass for me.
Well, that's very much the simplicity of 80s horror, though.
But it's not simple. It's complicating a simple concept. The simple concept would be do something. It would be the Giallo concept. Somebody wronged me. I'm getting revenge. That's a simple concept. Somebody wronged me by killing me because I was killing children, and now I'm getting revenge for being revenged upon. Like, that is just, that's mealy mouth to me. Like, that's always the issue I had with Freddy Krueger as a character. I'm like, why do you get to get revenge? Like, I'm more of a Paul Kersey guy. Like, yeah, you kill my wife, you kill my mute daughter, I'm going to shoot you with a 44 Magnum.
Well, I mean, I get it because it's all about the moral complication of the parents in that first movie, where it's, we thought we were doing the right thing, and ultimately we did the thing that put our children in more harm's way. Like, had we just, you know, gone through the right channels and made sure he was taken out and never hurt anybody again, as opposed to just fucking murdered him and burnt him alive and then hid his bones in a junkyard.
Which is funny, because you think the appropriate channels would be the police. And they talk about in this movie how John Saxon was in on that group murder and was a policeman.
Yeah. Well, isn't the backstory of what it was like he got out on a technicality. And so they had him, but he got out of technicality. And so you got an angry mob with torches and pitchforks, literally, and went and murdered him.
Yeah.
But it's all, you know, it's revenge for that mob mentality thing. It's the, well, you know, might makes right. And, you know, the ends justify the means.
But see, I guess
what works about the original Nightmare is that the ends ultimately, the means ultimately cause a much worse end, creates an entity that they can't stop that way. But yeah. I do like this idea that what if Freddy Krueger, this is what he was aiming for all along. Like, he just wanted this supernatural power and keeps fighting for it.
I'm in danger of revealing too much about myself, but I'm okay with the mob mentality putting down somebody like Freddy Krueger who's killing children. So to me, it never made sense that he would then get revenge on people who were... Yeah, I'm not going to say anything further because I feel like I'm going to just... You're going to see too much behind the curtain of Brian, and I'm not comfortable with that.
Well, I dig it from the karmic wheel perspective. Okay, like, the whole idea enough. That whole concept that comes from Nietzsche, you know, be careful when you hunt monsters, lest you become a monster yourself.
Is that kind of like the, when you set on a revenge plot, dig two graves kind of thought process? Okay.
Yeah.
I could see that.
And that's what I think is really effective about that first movie. But once Freddy becomes a supernatural entity beyond that first film is complete. You know, she disbelieves him and he's destroyed. Mm-hmm. Like, Nightmare can be watched on its own and you don't feel like it justifies a series from it. Mm-hmm. And it takes the mess of two to create what becomes a real series and a real slasher horror villain. But at that point, as they build the mythology, they never really establish the why until Wes Craven's New Nightmare, which we covered a couple years ago.
Which is interesting. I'm glad you brought that up because segue. The original script of this movie is something I think we should talk about. Did you read up on the original script of this film?
Well, years ago, I did not bother to.
See if this sounds familiar. See your aspersions aside. See if this sounds familiar. The original premise involved Freddy invading the real world and haunting the actors and crew responsible for.
Yeah, I remember that.
The Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, when we talked about that on Seven, and they threw that out.
There was also the original version of this idea that was a lot darker. Like, you know, things like, for example, a character, I believe it's, is it Joey, the one who makes puppets and the one who sleepwalks? I believe that was his name.
No, Joey's the one who doesn't speak.
Joey's the one who doesn't speak. So is it Philip? Maybe Philip's the one that sleepwalks. But anyway.
By the way, that is one of my favorite murders in all of Elm Street.
Oh, yeah. And we're definitely going to have to talk in just a minute about the effects of this movie. But in the original script, he's sleepwalking and literally walks out into traffic and is hit by an ambulance. And that's how he dies. Like, the irony alone of something like that is pretty heavy. But there were a number of other things. There was a character who commits suicide early in the movie that then both Kristen and Nancy are communicating with in the dreams. There was just a lot of stuff that really...
And this one's really dark to begin with. Like, the stuff that stayed in is dark. Like, the whole element of the ex-junkie and how Freddy kills her. And, you know, that scene of her old... injection points, like working his mouths and begging for drugs, just going,
yeah, oh god,
it's so creepy and wrong and so nails. This is why I love this movie so much. This movie really nails why Freddy is a truly evil monster, because what he delights in is tormenting people. He loves suffering. He doesn't love killing. He loves suffering, and he has to make these kids suffer, and he fucks with them in the worst way. It's why he loves picking, it's what you mentioned earlier, like, which is funny enough, but he loves tormenting the disabled,
yeah,
because he knows it's an easy score. Like, well, it's a layup for him to make fun of the kid in the wheelchair.
Yeah, and speaking of the kid in the wheelchair, and I think this speaks to your point exactly, you see him stab that kid with his claw, just like a quick, like, and kill him. And I remember watching it this time and going, that's interesting. You don't see that much in the sequels.
No.
Where he just straight up, like, kills somebody with a blade. He, like, picks him up and then just stabs him kind of in the neck area and then just drops him. And I'm like, oh, that's not his style. And it's because he, like you said, he likes the torment.
And he actually, yeah, he tormented him already.
Yeah.
He had a wheelchair come and chop his leg so that he couldn't even walk in his own dream anymore. And for him, that was the victory.
Well, he tried to, but Joey used his wizard master power to destroy the wheelchair and then tried to use his wizard master power to get rid of Freddy. And Freddy's like, I'm sorry, I play Warhammer. I don't know what to do, man. Sorry, fuck you. And just stabs him in the neck. And I remember seeing that kill and going, oh, that's actually kind of rare for Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, he just gets the job done. In fact,
that's a Michael Myers move, not a Freddy Krueger move.
Yeah, yeah. It was, but he had already tormented him.
Yeah.
So, and again, this movie's very lean. Like, this is a movie that feels like it probably should have been 2 hours and instead is just like a nice, lean 98 minutes.
Yeah.
Because it's one of those movies that those of you who have watched it maybe years ago and haven't revisited it and listening to it, like, oh, I've seen this movie a couple of times. I can listen to this podcast. Probably remember this having the dream sequences be more spread out than they are. Mm-hmm. But really, no, there is one big long dream sequence where the big fight scene happens where all of these kids die. That's all in the same sequence.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, and here's the point I would like to mention. Nancy gets these fucking kids killed. She's the hero of this movie. Like, the movie she's the one who believes. She's the one who comes in and teaches them how to use their powers. Like, she's like, we got to go in and save Joey. Like, you know, Joey did survive this movie, thankfully, because had he died, it would have been really heartbreaking that, hey, we went in to save him and we were getting the order of Hypnosil tomorrow, so you kids all would have lived and we would have lost Joey. But instead we went in and traded four lives, my dad, me, and two other kids to save the kid, the horny kid who doesn't speak.
You are watching Saving Private Joey.
Yes, that is what it is, Saving Private Joey. Like, she gets these fucking kids killed to save Joey, and that's admirable and all, but you know what?
Screw your greater good.
You got John Saxon killed. You could have waited for the hypnosil.
You know what? That's why I don't like Heather Langenkamp. That's why I'll never forgive her. She got John Saxon killed in these movies. Which, by the way, we need to talk about that kind of B storyline going on
under
the Enter the Dreams showdown, which is that John Saxon and the doctor of this facility are looking for the buried remains of Freddy Krueger so that they can make the ground sacred with holy water and defeat him. And so John Saxon leads the doctor to the place where the parents, after they basically burned Freddy Krueger alive, buried his remains, which, by the way, did you notice the car, the trunk that he's buried in?
Yeah.
It's the same Cadillac as they're driving away in at the end of the first one.
Yeah, that's why it's that's why in the dream sequence it's the Cadillac.
So
It's why they made it the Cadillac, was it was the callback to the movie,
right.
Tying it all together. Again, one of the great things about this movie is how its mythology really does build with the other films.
And it actually does enhance the ending of the first movie, because there's a conversation between the doctor and Nancy where he asks about her mother and she says she died in her sleep. And you realize at that moment that the ending, the coda of Nightmare on Elm Street, is you watching the mom be killed by Freddy in her sleep. It's not a nightmare the kids are having. It's a nightmare the mom was having.
Yeah.
And she dies. But I love that this gives rise to, and this will lead in beautifully to our discussion of the effects of this movie, a Ray Harryhausen showdown between John Saxon and the skeleton of Freddy Krueger. I love the effects in this movie.
Who doesn't have his glove?
He doesn't have his glove. No.
I mean, that's also really, like, it's an emasculated Freddy Krueger. But he is existing in the real world. He's working in the real world through his own body, which wouldn't make sense without two. Because we're two, where he does act. So we see he can manifest things in the real world beyond, you know, a sleeper.
It's because his ascension into the real world is where we get the line that became repeated throughout sequels, which is, you are all my children now.
Yeah.
This movie, speaking of things that introduce, and we'll get back to the effects in just a second, put a pin in that, put the nitro back in the box. We need to talk about the fact that this movie gives us one of the signature elements of Freddy Krueger. And I've done a lot of research, and I may be wrong. I will be willing to eat crow if I am, but I'm pretty sure that Nightmare on Elm Street 3 is the first time that Freddy Krueger rampantly uses the word bitch. Suddenly, everything he says is bitch this and bitch that, and it only gets worse through the sequels. But we are introduced to it in one of his greatest one-liners before A Kill of All Time.
Fuck the prime time, bitch!
Which is where he kills the character who's convinced she's going to be a TV star by slamming her head into a television. Welcome to prime time, bitch. Which, by the way, was improvised on set. The only line that he was supposed to say before killing her was, "This is your big break in television, Jennifer." But then during the rehearsals, during the different takes, he also said, of his own accord, "Welcome to prime time." By him, I mean Robert Englund. "Welcome to prime time, bitch." Which then becomes him calling everybody bitch to a degree that Rick and Morty made fun of this character by introducing, I can't remember the name of the character, but it's basically Freddy Krueger. And he just, like, every other word is the word bitch. To the point that when someone did something really nice for him, he goes, "Aw, bitch." Like, it becomes a signature of Freddy Krueger going forward.
It
does. I love that it starts in this movie.
It does. And I think that it kind of becomes his catchphrase. He doesn't really have one. And this is the 80s, and catchphrases were the thing. And adding bitch to it also made the character angrier and more wrong, which is something...
it's true.
Well, I mean, no, but that's functionally what this is doing, because... You know, the further away you get from the first movie, the more the ookiness is removed from what his origin is. It's, you know, it's less, hey, this is a guy who is murdering little kids, to, well, this is now just a supernatural entity that's murdering people. And it's got to be more than just killing things. And you've got to up that in some way and make him awful in his own way. So you hate him for more reasons than just he's dangerous. And they were upping the personality. And that's where the jokes got more and more. And that's where it got campier and campier. And then you end up with 5 and 6 and the messes that those are. And it's a very interesting tactic that in retrospect got abused.
Yeah, abused to the nth degree. It became self-parody. I mean, as you go further along in these sequels, Freddy becomes
self. But the movies, once you get to Freddy versus Jason, it is parody.
Yeah,
like this is campy. This is fun. You're supposed to be having a good time.
I would say long before that, it becomes parody.
No, it does. But by that point, it is sheer parody. It's literally okay. The whole reason you're watching this movie is to see Freddy fight Jason at the end. In fact, so much so that at the critic screenings of Freddy versus Jason, they didn't show the last minute of the movie to critics. Because they were you have to go to the movie theater to find out who wins.
You know what I would have loved if instead of showing the ending, they just had that card come up that goes, this is how it could have happened.
No, they had a card that came up, that literally came up and said, if you want to find out who wins, come and see the movie on opening day. It was like, it infuriated critics.
And for a lot of critics, borrowing from the AVP tagline, no matter who wins, you lose. But I actually love Freddy versus Jason. But
I really enjoy that.
I get
movie
why
as
that
well.
Would be frustrating.
But the thing is it is more of a comedy than it is a horror film. Like you would not be like, let's watch a good horror film tonight. I know. Let's watch Jason X and Freddy versus Jason. Like it's like no, those movies.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. But holy shit, is that a great double feature? Okay, so my question is this, Cargill: what is the best kill or the best effect in this movie?
Well. I think the
or I guess I should say favorite. Maybe best is too.
Too
absolute. Maybe
the puppeteer
we'll go with
one. Oh, I love that so one. Great. Like ripping the guy's nervous system out and using him as a puppet, and then walking him to go commit suicide.
Well, but even before that, I love the fact that they did stop motion to make that puppet morph into Freddy. I love that effect.
Oh, that looks great as well, but that's not a kill. Like, that whole sequence
is
great.
I'm sorry. I meant, like, kills, effects, I'm kind of lumping into the same category for this question.
See, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about that we hadn't addressed yet. One of the things I really like about this movie is the idea that Freddy has kind of gone underground. Mm-hmm. This whole idea that he's tormenting these kids, but he's actually legitimately getting them to commit suicide in ways that people are like, oh, he was sleepwalking and fell off of a tower. That's so unfortunate. And it's like, that Freddy is like trying to make these people, you know, like, and then of course he kind of goes off the rails halfway through and is all of a sudden, you know, he pulls a woman into a television set and like nobody.
I would love to know how, but you know what? It's funny you mentioned that. There is the hospital staff isn't like, well, we really need to investigate this. Something is clearly not right. They're just like,
nobody says that shit's spooky.
Nobody fucking said, like, how do you write that one off? That she jumped up into the television to hang herself and then was dangling at an angle that's not natural? Like, you can't write that one off. And yet the movie kind of supposes that they did.
Yeah. Yeah, it really, that is one of the other slight kind of mild flaws to this, that doesn't happen. But again, with the leanness of the movie and how quickly it moves along through what it's doing, it functions.
Yeah.
But again, the 2 points that I brought up, this is not a perfect film, but it is a great one.
See, and I feel like it's why it's perfect for a show like ours, is that it is the third installment of a slasher franchise. And so your expectations are wildly low, but Chuck Russell is one of those guys that from his early days, as we mentioned, as an AD, he wants to be the best at whatever it is that he's doing. And when you're making a slasher sequel, make the best slasher sequel you possibly can. And that's what he and Darabont do with A Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
Okay, so here's a Sophie's choice.
Oh, God. We've had a lot of these. I don't know which one's my favorite of the ones you've thrown at me. It's real Sophie's choice.
Yeah, but no, here's a Sophie's choice for you. Is this the best horror sequel of any of the franchises?
Oh, that's even bigger. I thought you were just going to say the best part 3, which would be a struggle in and of itself.
No, but is 3 better than any Friday sequel or better than any Halloween sequel?
Yeah. It is.
See, this is how my feeling on it.
It's not my favorite, but if
we have a friend who has just shown up that in between edits, who's sitting over here just shaking his fucking head. Rod Paddock, would you lean over to the microphone and just share which one you think is superior? Why we're wrong?
Friday the 13th Part 2 by far is better.
You think 2 is better than Nightmare 3?
Yes.
Huh.
I thought he was going to say Ghoulies 3, but that's fine.
Can you say Jason?
I can. But if I say it 3 times, Murphy shows up and we have to make room on the microphone.
See, in fact, 2 isn't even my favorite Friday sequel.
Mine either.
So, and we discussed that in our
But you know whose favorite Friday sequel it is? Jason Murphy.
Jason Murphy.
Because it's the one where we see where Jason Voorhees shits. And apparently that's a big deal to him. Go back and listen to our episode on Friday the 13th Part 7 where Murphy describes his strange obsession with Voorhees defecation.
No, it's not his defecation. It's the fact that we walk into Voorhees' place and you see Voorhees' disgusting shitter over in the corner and he's like, that's where Jason shits. That terrifies
I feel me. Like what you said and what I said are exactly the same thing. Like, you said it's not what you said and then described something that was exactly what I said.
You made it sound a lot more fecal than creepy.
No. Murphy's not looking for Jason to take a shit on somebody. I'm just saying he's obsessed with where
it's German Jason shots of films.
Yeah, exactly. Friday. What the fuck were we talking about? How did we get on
Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
We'll blame Rod Paddock. Yeah, blame Rod.
Yeah, I usually do. But so I think the doll is one of the best effects in this movie. And I found out that the way they did that is they did stop motion in reverse to where they basically would create a vague face with clay. Don't take a shot. Don't listen to me. Stop playing that drinking game.
Shots.
The opinions of Junk Food Cinema do not represent those of Junk Food Cinema.
Everybody!
That's like my, you know, I am the Marty McFly of drinking. I think I've told you this before. Like, if I get dared to do something drink related, I have to do it. And that song is like my kryptonite. If I'm not going to do shots tonight. And that song comes on, it's like, motherfuck.
I was out of beer and I'm like, do you want wine? You're like, I don't drink wine. But yes.
But that's the thing, is like, that song is my Rolls Royce. Like, I will crash into it every time. but the effect where they basically make a doll's head that looks vague, they will take a 1 second frame, and then they will make it look progressively more like Freddy Krueger as they go along. Or I'm sorry, they did it backwards. They made it look like Freddy Krueger.
And then mashed it up?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
And then they did it in reverse. It's so fucking cool.
That's neat.
A lot of the, like, with like one or two exceptions, all the effects in this movie hold up, and that is damned impressive.
Yeah, no, there's, in fact, it's weird. Like, the giant Freddy snake creature looks more real than the moment when Freddy is holding Kincaid up and then vanishes.
Yeah.
Because, like, that, they actually, like, you see some of the green coming through on that. That seems like, in this day and age, that would be a much simpler thing to do than the big Freddy monster. But we haven't even mentioned that. Giant Freddy snake.
Oh, the phallic Freddy.
Dude, Freddy Snake is so fucking cool and creepy.
It's my favorite Metal Gear Solid character, Freddy Snake.
And then it has what I know you're trying to joke. I'm trying to talk about one of the coolest fucking parts of this movie, asshole.
The look on your face as you're just trying to plow through my bullshit is
I'm really trying to plow through the bullshit.
It's like Jason taking a shit.
Yeah.
Which Murphy would be very interested in.
So you've got Freddy Snake, and he's, you know, And we've got this character. She summons in Nancy, and Nancy's there. And the look on Freddy's face when he goes, "You," like, that's just like, that is like the, I, for me, it's the one of the iconic moments of this film and of the franchise, of like Freddy, like, "You fucking beat me before.
Yeah.
Holy shit. You made my life suck for a while.
Yeah.
Fuck you." Like, you just see it. And it's such a cool moment.
Also, does that facial expression on a snake-like version of a character in the movie remind you of anything? Because it reminded me a lot of the snake Beetlejuice. Like, the facial expressions on the snake Beetlejuice, it just, something about the way that this thing is smiling with that kind of, like, half-slanted, like, it just reminded me a lot of
Reminded me a lot of Dreamscape. I mean, that's the thing.
Oh, there
is,
you go.
You know, you've got the Snake Man in Dreamscape. You've got all that claymation stuff like we're seeing here. Like,
so many parallels. Like, you can tell the same person wrote both movies.
Yeah,
for sure.
No, it really, and that he was borrowing from his big success film, you know, like Dreamscape.
And
hey,
I
made Dreamscape.
Talk about somebody who knows how to really get the audience's heart involved. Like, in the Blob remake, he fucking kills a child.
Oh.
A child that he's endeared the audience to through the whole, that is ballsy.
And he made this whole batch of movies that really stands up. Like, he's a director that most people don't know who Chuck Russell is. And yet when you mention to horror fans, oh, The Blob remake, oh, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, those are fucking classics.
Well, that's probably because his most successful movie of all time is not a horror film. And it's one that most people don't even remember that he directed, which was The Mask with Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's probably, like, it gets a little skewed when you start talking about that. But, hey, speaking of that, Cargill, just one quick question to kind of wrap things up on. If you had to guess, which three Nightmare on Elm Street movies do you think made the most money? If you had to rank them 1, 2, 3.
I would say 2, 3, 1.
Okay. The answer is the biggest moneymaker, Freddy vs. Jason. Second,
I wasn't even counting Freddy vs. Jason, yeah.
Strangely, number two, Nightmare on Elm Street 4, The Dream Master. And number three is this one. So this was the third most successful movie of the entire franchise. And it was, and when I say successful, like, this was making way more money than the Friday sequels at this point. This movie clocked in $44.7 million in 1987 off a $4.5 million budget.
Oh, and as a kid at the time, Jason movies were growing tired, and the kids were not connecting with the Jason movies, with the Fridays. But we were all about fucking Freddy.
Well, I mean,
The thing is,
there was more gas in the tank with a Nightmare on Elm Street sequel.
I was too young to be able to go and see three in a theater, but I saw every single one after that in a theater.
Sure.
Because I was 12 when this one came out. This summer we're talking about 12-year-old Cargill. And 12-year-old Cargill was not allowed to see horror films. My parents would let me watch rated R movies, but they would not let me watch horror films, so I could only go over and watch them at my friend's house during sleepovers. And so I'd do a lot of sleepovers when I was a kid, which my parents thought was weird and had no idea it was because we were going over and we were just watching Nightmare on Elm Street fucking movies.
Yeah.
Like, that's my horror education, is being 12 years old and every other weekend crashing at my friend's house so we can watch horror movies.
I remember this was the last franchise I got into because I was too freaked out by it, because my aunt was a few years older than me. She was about 7 years older than me, and she was really into Nightmare on Elm Street movies. And I remember as a very little kid, like, the idea of Freddy Krueger, like, I was okay with Jason and Michael Myers, but something about Freddy Krueger just did not, to the point that it took me until I moved to Austin to finish watching all the sequels of Nightmare on Elm Street, because it was just like, it's still lingered a little bit.
Best idea of all of the slashers, of all of the long-running slasher films. It's the one that is just such a brilliant idea, because these movies give you nightmares, and the guy in the movies kills you in your nightmares, making the nightmares even more terrifying. And I remember as a kid waking up several times from Nightmare on Elm Street nightmares and not wanting to go back to sleep. Like, I was terrified to go back to sleep because I knew I was going to have the dreams again. Like, it was so effective of an idea, which is why we're still talking about the series to this day, even though, you know, much like, you know, several other horror series, only two or three of the films are really legitimately great. Mm. Like, this series, I honestly feel, has only two really great entries, and four that I really like total. And then a couple that I just don't, you know, but, you know, not nearly as much as, like, as we talked about with the Friday series, where there's so much, or like with the Hellraiser series, where I think there's only three good Hellraisers and they've made like nine.
I also really love, before we wrap up, I just want to mention, I love the poster for this movie.
Oh God. Yes.
I think Drew Struzan did the original, like, Nightmare on Elm Street poster, but this one is somebody who is definitely influenced by Struzan and does this amazing larger-than-life poster that feels very New Line, very Roger Corman, very Joel Silver, very Canon Films, because there are elements of this poster that are definitely not in the film at all. Like, all of the characters and the way they're designed do not correspond to any of the actors in the movie, and one of them is holding a mace that is not in the film. So there's a lot of, like, this'll sell the movie that don't actually have antecedents in the actual film. So it feels very much like that sort of shyster producing mechanism that I think is hilarious. But it is a beautifully painted, really intense, really awesome encapsulation of what this movie is. And I dig it.
Also, just a small little aside. We talked about Hellbound and Hellraiser 2 a couple times this episode.
With Chuck Norris.
If you watch these.
He's not in it.
Which, by the way.
Chuck Pyle.
they do make a really great double feature. They're both really fun installments of two different series. But what's interesting is that Hellbound Hellraiser 2, which was made a year later, they practically clone Patricia Arquette's wardrobe for one of the characters in this movie. Like this, the girl who doesn't speak in Hellbound Hellraiser 2 is wearing the exact same clothes and has her hair done the exact same way and looks a lot like Patricia Arquette, to where it's like, wait, you were like, hey, let's make her look like the lead in that movie. Like, I don't know. It could have been accidental, but when you watch it, it's like, wow, she's wearing the same, like, same color and style of shirt, and her hair is done the same way as the heroine from this big hit movie from last year. I just found it odd.
In the name of Lorik, Prince of Elves, demon be gone!
Well, that brings us to the junk food pairing, and this week I went with something pretty simple. Until your training is complete, or until you can get your hands on some Hypnosil, delay your showdown with Freddy by guzzling an entire pot of black coffee. Actually, I remember one of the things in the documentary Never Sleep Again, when they're talking about the first Nightmare on Elm Street movie, Wes Craven talks about where he got the idea for Nightmare on Elm Street was from this article he read about Cambodian refugees who escaped Pol Pot and the death squads, who were had such severe nightmares that they would sometimes die in their sleep just from the shock. So one of these refugees told his foster family, like, I really don't want to sleep, I'm having these nightmares, blah, blah, blah. And the family, with all the best intentions, was like, you really need to sleep, and all this other stuff. And then he died in his sleep, and in his closet they found caffeine pills and a tiny coffee pot where he had been brewing black coffee to try and stay awake so that he didn't have to face these nightmares, which is like super, like, that's what Nightmare on Elm Street becomes.
Yeah.
Is this real life story. So it just kind of made me think about that. It made me think about all of the Nightmare on Elm Street sequels and think, you know, if you had black coffee instead of Diet Coke, which one character uses, or burning yourself with a cigarette, which character uses.
She doesn't use Diet Coke.
No, but Kincaid does.
Oh, no. What I was referring to was she drinks Diet Coke chasing down a spoonful of Folgers.
That's true.
She pops Folgers, a spoonful black coffee. Of Folgers
then
downs a Diet Coke, which is one of the grossest. I was afraid that was going to be your junk food pairing.
That's fucking teamwork. Well done, Cargill. So Folgers black coffee is going to be this week's junk food pairing.
Oh, no. Just drink good black coffee. you don't need instant. Like, don't do that to yourself.
This episode brought to you by not Folgers, because we are talking shit about it. Well, that's going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Please, if you have not become a patron yet, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema to listen to our episode On the Car as the inaugural Summer of 77 miniseries exclusive to our patrons. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
On Twitter, twitter.com/ or at Massaworm, MASSAWIRM. And then Facebook, facebook.com/Massaworm. Also, this week, you can find me on Ken Plume's A Bit of Chat, in which Ken Plume calls me up on Skype and we literally bullshit for 3 hours. If you've ever wanted to listen to me talk about breakfast food, my time on Doctor Strange, and all sorts of crazy stuff, including some film talk, track down A Bit of Chat.
Well done. Well, you can find me online at Bry Guy Salisbury on
Neither
Twitter.
Of us can do this week.
I don't know.
Like, we're off our game. I blame Rod.
I blame the move. I blame the fact that I'm a month out from D-Day, and it's too much.
As in Daddy Day.
Daddy Day, Delivery Day. Yeah, it's going to be a heck of a thing.
Someone's going to be a daddy.
# somebody's father. Listen to our last several episodes and think to yourself, # somebody's father. But we're going to go ahead and wrap up, and I just want to end it like this. DJ Junk Food here, urging all those dream warriors out there to stay sharp, sleep well, and docking out with your cocking out.